This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, so I'm gonna call the meeting to order. Welcome to the second meeting of the Codes and Judicial Committee of the University Assembly. I'd like to welcome Hazel Hall as the new employee assembly appointee to the committee. So let's all give a warm welcome to Hazel. The first item on the agenda is talking about the Community Bill of Rights. So unless anyone has any objections to considering that agenda item first, then I'd like to begin discussion on that. Are there any objections? Nope. Okay, then we will consider the Community Bill of Rights first. So does anyone want to talk about the structure of the working group?
I guess you just go over it.
Okay, so basically last year, UA Resolutions 9 and 10 established that the Codes and Judicial Committee will have a Community Bill of Rights working group, and that that working group will be responsible for developing a draft of a Community Bill of Rights, and, you know, made the bylaw and edited the bylaws of the UA to adjust for that. Other than that, there really isn't that much established. At the last meeting, I presented to you what Sarah Ballack had given me about the Community Bill of Rights, or a potential draft that she said she'd been working on. She's a former CJC member and former president of the Student Assembly. But other than that, we don't, as of right now, have a really clear idea of what the working group is going to be like, what the format's going to be, and really how long the time frame is. So I wanted to open up that discussion for the group to do. Yep.
I think at the last meeting, Mr. Greg Medley had actually a very good point, which is funny because he's departed, but he said that breaking it up into, I guess, four parts, where there'd be a preamble, a general, I guess, statements, then one for the students, one for the employees, and one for the faculty, understanding that there are intrinsically differences in terms of what affirmative rights you may have because of status, tenure, etc. And he said that also may be a good idea, and the more I thought about it, I realized it might also be a good idea because it allows it to be broken up easily, creates an easy structure for that. Additionally, it also makes it harder for the product to be abandoned insofar as if you have two of the three or three of the four, it's much harder to say it's done instead of just when just walk away from it. I also think it's practical in that it gives us the ability to work on it in stages. This is an enormous undertaking. With the goal of actually not creating anything new, but merely restating and codifying the rights and privileges that are already considered to be standard and accepted throughout the community.
Yeah, I think I liked that discussion when it was brought up. You said, again, I think it makes sense that the employees, faculty, students are all going to have different rights in different areas of the code. And so also maybe the working group could just be make sure it has a person from each of those. It's just designated to be the point person for making sure that section of it is being written and is being handled. And of course, they can be encouraged to go back to their own assembly to find people there to assist them. And so the working group at this place, this committee is that, it's supposed to be like a steering committee of other groups that might form up that. So, for example, I was handling the graduate student side. Then I can go back to GPSA or out of these committee, grab those people and say, all right, we're making this Bill of Rights, let's get this written.
So you think that we should make sure that we have like one point person from each constituency to kind of, okay.
Just to be responsible for their section of it being, because, the more people you ask to do something, the less likely it's going to get done. In my experience, if you have one person to do it, then you know exactly who you have to yell at when it doesn't work.
Fair point.
Yeah, I can see this being a lengthy process. I mean, I know that Kathy and I were on the committee last year, and it took us the entire year to actually get this, even the sort of mandate to establish this document. I think it'll probably be glacial. I think everybody is worth it, definitely, and I think that we will need people who are committed in it for the long haul. I think that we should probably go into thinking that this will be a very long-term process, that it's not going to be done this semester or next semester, and maybe not in the semester after that, but yeah.
It's a lot of semesters.
Yeah. I'm excited about this.
Yeah.
I think this group could take on the definition of what those groups are, because, you know, students is all encompassing, but actually there are different needs for graduate professional students than there are for undergrads. So we can come to an agreement on what those groups are, and again, less is more, and then try to work with some consistency for some basics, so that we're not, you know, we're referring to a complete and totally different document. There might be, you know, a core document and then an addendum or something.
I think a common format amongst all of them would be, you know, ideal, so that there's not just, it's not four or three completely different documents put around. It is one unified document that everyone can read through.
Right.
So maybe, but I mean, it sounds like what Richard said and what, maybe have a four-person, I guess, subgroup that's appointed by the CJC, a lead from the four, I guess, we go up to four constituents, I believe, the undergraduate, a graduate, a faculty member, and a staff member, to say, okay, you are the relevant leads. You can, if you need to, I know there are many students who are involved and are excited about this, and I'd imagine there's interest to find others, but these four are the ones who are the points, and then after that, they can interact with their constituencies, those who are interested, and those who have expertise, as necessary, and they can call upon support of the CJC. Because there's a point where this is such a huge undertaking, it needs to come, the CJC is going to oversee it, but it needs to be given to a group that's going to get down to the trenches and figure out all the nitty-gritty, and the obviously if it is a disagreement, it can come back, but trying to get them off to the races so they can have their own meetings and get moving. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And I think that the other thing is, and I think that one of the main values would be in like delegating that would be that, you know, the CJC has like a lot of other things that we need to do. So I think that there's a lot of value in having like a few point people who are on the CJC who work on this outside of the CJC and maybe also in the CJC. Who can interact with their communities. So one other thought that I had that I wanted to bounce off you guys was, how would you, like, what if we attach the Community Bill of Rights as an appendix to the campus code?
That could work out fine. It's also fine to have it lived somewhere in the body. As an appendix, I feel sometimes it's easier to modify if things don't change or define what we thought might work, doesn't work. But I expect to be completely false. It just seems like it, oftentimes when you've got an appendix, it's easier to deal with it that's integrated into the code. There are also some ways that if we end up referring to it within the code context of the direct code, it's easier to refer to the appendix than it is to try to go back to finding the different various places where it needs to be amended if we amend something small.
I think also, I mean, remember there's two parts that were brought up. The one was trying to centralize policy and one was the actual Bill of Rights. I think tacking it on, it makes it easier to say, okay, it's one, you open up the code document at the end, this is the part where it says that 6.4 has precedence over certain parts. Here's another part saying affirmative rights. They are one cohesive document. The process of which you define them into if they need to modify it is cohesive. I think it creates it. Because if you start creating it so it's separate, you may only be adding to the clutter that we're trying to prevent.
Yeah.
Another question on that though is, so will the Bill of Rights only pertain to things in the code, or will it also pertain to Clause 6.4 or other policies out there? If it's not just things in the code of conduct, then does it then make sense for it to be an appendix in the code?
I don't know that you could do it. Because what separates code from policy is employment. So there are certain things that I think policy is held separate because it's of the nature of an employment of an individual, not the matriculation of an individual.
And I think this was mentioned at the beginning of the year, everyone's under the code, technically, and in certain ways, but there are certain degrees, students primarily, faculty are under it partially, but that's faculty handbook, and then staff are arguably the least. They have they are mentioned in some ways, but generally it's left to HR and kept outside the code. I think, I mean, this is obviously open for debate. It, for the sake of getting something on paper and moving initially, and maybe prove to stick to the code, see how we can, I mean, there is always the outside chance that this it doesn't work, something goes wrong. I think it's better to be manageable, and then they'll get it succeeded, and it's worked, and it's created value, and then you can go to the administration and the trustees if necessary, and say, we'd like to encompass this, this, and this. What are your thoughts? And have a dialogue. After you have a work product, to say, here's something that's worked, and it's not just a discussion or a hope.
Right. And you can always just sort of tag them on it and say, you know, about the women's rights can be in violation of other university policies or something along those lines. The rationale, I think, is that while few cases of employees, faculty come to the judicial administrator, some do, but they always have to be something that would be outside of the course of their employment. So there are lots of HR ways to deal with something. Someone who steals from their own coffers is going to be treated differently than somebody who shoplifts from the campus store that's not an employee. So one is a violation of code, the other is a violation of policy. So I think that's
yep.
So just my recollection from the time this was first brought up, even by the former JCC, was that it's as much a resource as it is something documenting actual rights.
Right.
And hearing it as it's to be unfolded into the code, I think because of the thing that was just brought up about that Greg Mezzi had brought up, that there's different needs and the rights of community bill of rights for the staff, and Hazel probably could inform better, probably wouldn't involve much of the code. I mean, the code is explicit for what it is, but what we're talking about resource-wise doesn't live in the code. I hadn't envisioned this as part of the code in its original discussions. It's interesting that, you know, that it's being talked about in that way, but while you're envisioning this thing, I would also encourage you to think about what it would be as a standalone for the community. Because right now, even though, as you just mentioned, Matt, the code pertains to everybody, it's not really employed for everybody. It's really just as Chief Zoner just said too, rarely does it really attach or become something that's used for faculty and staff. But the Community Bill of Rights, as a resource guide for what are our rights rather than how we're going to comport ourselves, seems different to me. And I just offer that for your consideration.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thought is that a Community Bill of Rights, I don't know how easy it would be for it to be binding on administrative action unless it were in the campus code of conduct. So,
or it just becomes its own thing.
So my understanding, in fact, was last year when Bill Gagos got to the UA, my understanding always been that the purpose of this was not to create anything new so much as just to summarize what already exists.
Right.
There's no real need for authority over policy because we're not trying to change any policies. So we're not trying to make a change to policy before. All we're doing is saying, like, you know, that only means policy for example. But if you're and a violation under policy 6.4 is brought up, then, you know, these are the rights you have if that policy is invoked against you. And so, in that respect, that's where I envision this could live, not necessarily only as part of the code, but also just saying that if you're accused of any violation under any policy, these are the rights that you have. And that's why it would make and that's why it would make sense to have separate ones for employees, students, faculty, et cetera. If it's only going to be for the campus code of conduct, then I feel less of a need to actually break that up because the campus code is uniform in how it addresses violations. It doesn't actually address violations based on constituency. But if you're going to break it up by students and other groups, the students will probably focus on this entirely on the campus code, would some other policy. Of course, the employees will probably focus primarily on other policies if they're more likely to
So I think that brings up the fundamental question of like what the format of it is. So the way that it seems like the discussion is going, it seems like it's only going to incorporate existing rights, right?
Yeah.
That like we can specifically reference.
That's something that
right.
It's what can I do and what can't I do.
Right, exactly. Not what should I be able to do.
Right. And how I should do it.
Right. So in that case, I don't think it would, or my interpretation, it might not be the best idea to put it in the campus code of conduct. I would hope that we can hammer that out before we leave this room, so that the working group has something solid to go with. So,
if I may, it sounds like also. If we get a draft and we think it would be better suited to the code, I think right now it makes more sense to be standalone here in the discussion, thinking back to the original mandates. If we get something and we determine that it may be made better than in the code, it's something that the committee can consider at a future date if we get something that's different than what we're planning. The committee will be watching it, but there's obviously things can and will come up that were not anticipated and will need to be handled. I think at this point it may be prudent to say we have a rough format, an introduction, that's something for students, something for faculty, something for staff, and move on to that, and then after that, chart of the working group.
Please don't want to survive to get my own chair.
They're nuzzled in the corner.
Don't be afraid to ask
for Thank you very much.
So a few things that I've kind of that I've gathered from this discussion is that we don't want it in the campus code, and that it's going to have separate parts, and that the community and that the working group is going to have one kind of point person from each constituency. Is that just actually we should probably take a placard vote on that?
I would be a little off for the approach, especially since I have something to give it to something as a working group, but they may have different parts. It may not. You feel for
right.
It. And you know what? These apply to everybody across the board. Regardless of the process that you're going through, you have these rights.
Right.
And in that particular case, then you wouldn't necessarily have to separate things out.
So possibly give that as a starting point to the working group and say, here's what we've thought of, but however it does come out. I think the reason Mr. Mezzi brought that forward was giving a working group a mandate such as big as this could be almost where do you start, give this as a starting point and say you are empowered to take reasonable action. Here's what we were thinking, but if you find a better way, by all means, you're not constrained.
Mm-hmm. So I would think that for a mandate working group, it would not be unreasonable to expect by the end of this semester at least have a rough draft of the preamble sort of brought back to this group. So part of our mandate for work group just to just decide what is the mandate going to be. I like the idea of having at least only four people, one from each constituency.
Yeah.
That way we don't dilute the who do we point at to ask for something.
Yeah.
And they're mandated with coming up with by the end of the semester what the final format will be and sort of a preamble to it. If there is a preamble. But some type of introductory statement on this is what the process is going forward and sort of establish that. Because that's not unreasonable. It might have been reasonable to expect the full thing written in one semester, since this is no one's full-time job. But I think that might be a reasonable level to request for the working group.
My only addition or suggestion to that is that for the GPSA, if there's one person, I would really want them working closely with, if that's a graduate student, with a professional student, or vice versa. Sorry. Because we truly are are completely different in the way that we're run and the things we do and our schedules and our lives. So if we are going to do that tailoring, this is the student's little part, this is the faculty's, this is the staff, I would want to make sure it's not more specific to the graduate or the professional student. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that then there should be one of each of those sorts of students?
I was thinking that, but if you guys wanted as a four person, I would just say have whoever is the point for GPSA have basically a right-hand man, right-hand woman that works is the counterpart, whatever school it is.
Do we think that like, I'm an undergraduate, I don't know, are the rights that you think would belong to professional students and just other graduate students, are those, like, substantially different in terms of, like...
I think the rights are different, but the focus definitely would be, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually, like, in terms of rights, I know this was touched upon at some of our meetings, is that graduate students are workers, but the way our student workers are considered in the hospital is different. So that's one point that's code-wise, logistically-wise, is a bit different.
But it might be good to just get a very high level and then shop out to
right.
institutions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where,
right.
where are we erring? Yeah. We're going off track here a little bit. You know, what you see is problematic with where this is going.
I like the idea of sort of keeping it to only four people. I definitely agree that whoever is on the graduate side, but I think same can go for employees, as contractors and non-contract employees, or sorry, exempt or non-exempt employees. So I think that under each of the four will definitely have to do their due diligence to make sure they're addressing every sub-constituency, because definitely none of the four are truly uniform.
I think that's actually a good point system, though. A four-person group approved by this committee, they will then, so if I'm an undergraduate, I know for a fact there's a number of undergrads who have interest in this, have worked on it, I can then go talk to the constituents there, I can interact with the SA, graduates can split the professional and the PhD candidates. But I think that may be the way forward to make things efficient in terms of getting something off. It is necessary to be revisited, and obviously we can have status prior, I guess, progress reports to this committee is necessary, and the AUA even.
Mm-hmm. So far, just notes that I have. The working group will have four members. How would you guys, and then the format would be not in the campus code, and one thing that they would be tasked to accomplish by the end of this semester would be have a draft of a preamble. Is that okay? So preamble.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So what was the first part of what you said? Something about campus code.
The Bill of Rights would not live in the campus code. No problem. So, does anyone else have any comments on the format or the time frame? Because
I would actually almost add to the timeline, have a rough, I guess, framework. I think Gina mentioned that, of our framework or an outline of where the rest is going. Because if they go with the rough draft that's been discussed here as well,
right.
Mr. Menzies, or if they come a different way, to have an idea of where they're going so that they can get feedback and we can keep the discussion going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And towards what Connor has said, because this is going to be a long-term thing, the more the outgoing assembly can frame up for the incoming, they just sort of, it's like a relay rather than, I think it's less, then there's going to be a whole lot of time spent reconfiguring.
Maybe along those lines, you should establish a very loose timeline, and that way people have goals and directions. And granted, like in any project, there's going to be, it's not going to stick to that timeline, but that can be passed on, and people can strive for something.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something for us to do here, or for the committee to do when it's constituted?
Granted, it needs to have whoever makes this timeline needs to have a good idea of what all of this is going to entail. And granted, I don't know if the working group will have that knowledge or if that's something you guys want to have that knowledge. And so it depends where whoever has the greatest idea of what they want this ideally to be. And I guess whoever has also some of the greatest understanding of what it's going to take to get this actually into Cornell policy or
right. Yeah.
I don't know, speaking quite a bit. I think the goal, yeah.
Time.
The goal is that the working group is valid. I know Mr. Blair has a presentation for us.
Yes.
I know that the working group's time, I think, is important and that we're giving them a concrete goal for the end of the semester. Mm-hmm. I think leaving some of it up to them, and I don't think it's, I think it's completely fair to say that this group, the working group, is going to be interacting with the CJC informally. They're going to be consulting with members. I know I will be speaking with the working group. I'm sure Mr. Kaufman, the CJC chair, will also be maintaining an active eye. So it's not like the working group is going completely off on their own, but there's a point where the CJC needs to say, here's what we think we need. Mm-hmm. You've shown an interest. You have volunteered. We've approved you to serve, sit on this four-member panel. Go start working. You're going after the constituents, and then if something drastic happens, come talk to us, but start working through the nitty-gritty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Would you consider having the four members, perhaps the faculty, staff, and maybe even the grad professional student have a two-year term, again, for that continuity?
Hmm. I would think teammates 1 year would be fine. I mean, I like the sentiment of the two-year term, but I don't think that might just create more difficulty in finding people to take on the...
I think
faculty and staff tend to, I mean, it's easier actually to get things done. Sort of, Hazel, what do you think?
I think 2 year. That's just my opinion.
I think 2 years isn't like an unreasonable amount of time, but I want to make sure that if the CJC and the general UA want to, have someone new or one of the people on that committee doesn't want to... or one of the people on the committee, no longer wishes to continue working on it, that it be like really fluid and really easy to appoint someone. So,
I'd be concerned because I know that would at least limit undergraduate representation to current freshmen and sophomores. I think that's I definitely agree with the sentiment. I think that it would be great as a recommendation or a sort of implicit expectation that. If you're interested in serving on a committee, that you have to be interested in doing it for the long haul. But I'm not sure that it would be best to sort of codify that as a requirement.
What are you thinking?
I think 2 year terms have advantages. I know this is something that's been explored for the other many assemblies have looked at it because you spend a lot of time getting up to speed. By the time you're up to speed, you're now. And now you burned a semester roughly. And then a 2 year term, you're pretty much reducing the ratio of that. For students, that can create a problem. What might be an option is something in the middle where you find people who are interested and ask them would they be willing to serve for 2 years and give them the option of a 2 year term.
Yeah.
It's not encouraging.
Yeah.
So if you have a junior who's really passionate, so you're not boxing on undergraduates, for professional students they're here short as well, but those who are graduate students, especially those PhD track, are here longer so they can do 2 years as well if you find an underclassman who's interested. I think 1 year is the minimum commitment that we'd like, but if you're willing to do two or possibly three if you're still interested, I think we should allow the option for longer terms because that would give us the best of both worlds without boxing out someone who may be a junior or a senior, undergraduate, or a second year MBA student, etc.
Well, the shorter the term of commitment, the more aggressive the meeting schedule is.
That's true.
So if there's an opportunity to meet regularly, 1 year might be enough. But if you can't meet that regularly, then 1 year is nothing. It's two meetings, and you're like, oh, here we are again.
Exactly.
So
I'm gonna. I want to make sure that we have time to get everything in today. So I'm going to actually ask for a motion to kind of codify the discussion that we've been having. A motion to charge that the working group have four members, one from each constituency, and probably also that one of those members serve as like the working group leader or like the liaison between the CJC, the UA, and then the working group just to check in with us. And then that the format of the campus or that the format of the Bill of Rights be preamble and then So that the format by the end of the semester at least have a preamble finished and a timeline.
Was that all one motion?
Yeah, I guess that was all one motion, but that was...
Okay,
so...
Michelle, did you
call
that?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, well, we've got the audio recorded. So, does anybody here want to be the working group leader?
I guess I'd be comfortable doing that, unless anyone has any a position. I mean, I'm a sophomore, so I'd be interested in doing that for the.
You
were
kind of last year.
I did.
Yeah. He's one of the most veteran members. So is there anyone else from any other constituency that would be interested in being the working group leader? Because the first person who gets appointed to a committee technically is the chair, as per Robert's rules.
On the appointment letter, not in the meeting.
Oh. All right. Sorry, I must have missed that part.
You write it down, you write the chair first.
Okay.
Or you appoint the chair.
Fair point. Okay. Then, is there anyone... Okay, so then... Is there anyone else who's interested in being the working group leader?
I think
no. All right. Is there anyone else who's interested in being on the working group or in the working group? Because I guess that leaves graduate students and employees right now.
And
faculty. Well, but they're not here. Yes.
Right.
So we'll probably have to have that discussion again in the future.
It may be prudent, and I don't know if this was in the motion, I'm not sure if we're going to vote on the motion, but... It may be prudent to include that the working group members, obviously Mr. Hahn is a CJC member, but to have some that whoever is on the working group be approved by the CJC in an effort to make sure that they understand the commitment that we're asking of them, and it's not just someone who says, oh, that sounds nice, but doesn't really understand the gravitas and the hope that
we're going to put
them for this.
So are either of you interested in being in the working group?
No.
Okay. Okay.
I'll volunteer at 7 minutes.
You'll do it?
I'll do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Do we have any other employee volunteers?
I'm there. I think it's only me. Of course. Volunteer.
You'll do it?
I'll volunteer. Yeah.
Okay.
And we have an EA meeting tomorrow, but you're covering as an EA member or as an employee.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So you got three. Do we want to discuss the faculty now or?
I mean, Professor Wayne resigned and Professor Summerstall is not here. I think we can talk, and the faculty may also have, being the faculty do operate separately, generally a little bit separately, it may be prudent to discuss them separately.
Probably a good idea. Okay, so I'm going to motion to appoint Connor Hodges as the working group leader, Richard Walrath as the graduate student on the working group, and then Kathy Zoner as the employee on the working group. Can I get a motion?
I actually like looking at a lot of development has happened even just since our conversations, because I remember doing the search prior to see what other universities are doing, and it's all over the map. It's everything from minutia to, you know, your title to a cat-free workplace, just really broad. You're entitled to clean water, you know, really broad scope thing. So it'll be fun to, I like research. I like the opportunity to pull things together. I don't like minutia. I don't think it's beneficial to folks to really try to control on this really tiny level. Because there's just so many different ways that can go wrong. I'd be happy to be the broad voice as opposed to the minutia voice.
Okay, so...
Was there
I'm gonna need a second on the so you're making the motion. You'll second it. Okay. Let's take the formal vote. If you are in favor of the motion, raise your placard. What? Oh right, I don't need to raise my placard. Sorry, I'm really used to raising my placard. so we had what? 1, 2, 3, 4. Mitch, did you raise your placard? 5. Okay, so 6 to...
Are there any opposed?
Yeah, are there any opposed? Abstain? Yeah, I guess I have to abstain. So by a 6-0-1, the motion passes. So we have 3/4 of a working group. Yay. Okay, so I am actually going to call for a motion to move the time, place, manner restrictions up to the where we are presently on the agenda. That way, Chairman Emeritus Blair can present to us. So, can I have a motion? Motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. So we will now. Let's turn our attention to Mr.
So, thank you, Gabe, for inviting me over. I wasn't quite sure what you wanted. Your email was to discuss it. So the question I guess I first have is, do you need an orientation as to what we were, what we thought we were doing? And I would want to acknowledge from the outset that Kathy Zoner was on the working group as well, and so she doesn't need a formal invitation. Formally correct a man that you state that I might say that she disagrees with.
I would love an explanation. I have no idea.
Then let's
get the stage and then answer your questions. I did send Gabe the outdoor space working group final report. I don't know whether it was forwarded to you, and if it was, it may have been on Monday, and so I'm sure you
didn't.
Spent no other time reading it than, you know, of your time other than reading it. So the and everything I'll cover is essentially in there, but this is or was a direct fallout of what we call the incident of Hope Plaza of November 19th or something, 2012. An unfortunate, well, without the date, an unfortunate term, because I think all protest events of significance usually happen on Hope Plaza, so to call it the Hope Plaza incident is, you know, depends on when you came to Cornell, you know. But it was a... And again, Chief Zoner will correct me, but usually we have one or two major protests a year, but in a real, it can be as many as five or I suppose six. This one got contentious, and there were allegations of shoving and some other things. To my knowledge, nobody was actually hurt, but there was a lot of consternation, and there were some faculty present, and the faculty themselves were upset. And so there were several immediate groups that, you know, immediately took up the charge of investigating what happened and how do we deal with these things and were the police appropriate, were they trained appropriate, what is the Cornell policy on ID cards, amplified sound, you know, it was a big flail initially. And there were at least three major groups, I believe, that looked into it. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the University Faculty Committee, which is, I guess, what I would call the Executive Board of the Faculty Senate, it's a constituted piece of it, but it's not the entire Faculty Senate itself. It's the leadership of that group. Would I be framing that up correctly? Published a report with five recommendations, two of which came to the University Assembly. And one of those was to essentially deal with what is the campus code requiring in terms of permitting and things like that. And the other was the use of amplified sound. In 2014, the University Assembly ultimately passed University Assembly Resolution Number 9, which addressed half of that problem and said a permit is not required. And the campus code was suitably changed, in that time frame to change a sentence to make it absolutely explicit. A permit for protests, outdoor protests, is not required. That's not to say it can't be done or isn't desired, but it is not required. We came to no opinion on the use of amplified sound. There was an attempt to look at amplified sound from the standpoint of time, use, and manner restrictions of the spaces involved. And as we looked at that, every place had different time, place, and manner restrictions, if any, published. They were hard to locate, and some were approved by the building custodian, and others were approved by the dean. Okay, I mean, so if you're in the context of free speech and your right to assemble and pronounce that you are for or against something, if you're worried about Cornell abridging that, you know, being overly restricted, or a dean or somebody else, then you'd want to know that there is a process that ensures that the right level is making those decisions, that they aren't arbitrary and capricious and just to, pardon me, keep it, you know, let them protest in front of arts and sciences, but I don't want them in front of ILR. You know, so our rules are, to use our space requires a $5,000 indemnity policy. You know, what student group, you know what I mean? things like that could be misused. And so this is where this all gets very, very tricky. I think we all kind of have an understanding of what we hope would happen and how people would respect and, you know, things. But if it gets contentious and certain people then read all the rules and then they try and split the creases, right? So we couldn't comment on the use of amplified sound, which as our investigation confirmed, is one of the main reasons that things spin out of control. When there's a protest and a counter-protest and everybody wants to be heard, and sharing that and being able to express that, and then either the manager, event managers get pulled in, or and then the Cornell police get pulled in, and things ramp up emotionally. So how can we improve that? From the so we passed this resolution, we sent it to then President Scorton, and he mulled it over and for a good bit of a good while, and you know then we started getting on to potential transitions and stuff, and people got worried. And ultimately, he looked at the breadth of the problem, and he decided to use his authority to appoint a working group to work on it. So we had initially, the UA thought would come to the CJC, and when he made this appointment, which included members of the assemblies, but when he made this appointment and didn't go through the CJC, I myself was a little, well, I'm not sure what I think about that, but he's engaging on an issue. He turns out he did us a favor. Because as we investigated it, we needed deans and the chief of Cornell Police and student activists and lawyers like Risa Leibowitz, Professor Risa Leibowitz, who's an ardent free speech advocate. We needed all of that, and there's no way that you would have effectively commanded all those people to meet several times to discuss this, an issue where even the Supreme Court doesn't have universal decisions, right? So he did us a favor. He was right. And so I'm glad we didn't make hay about that. But at the start, you know, we talked about it. The committee met several times. We broke the task down. We're asked to do five things. And for those of you who haven't looked at it, what President Scorton charged the working group to look at was, and this is in the documents that Gabe has and has sent, so define what qualifies as an outdoor space and what should have written time and place rules. Suggest how those rules should be developed, coordinated, and approved. Determine where these rules should be published so that they are easily accessible to faculty, staff, and students. Gather information that is currently published across the university and create a template of best practices. And so that's what we tried to do. We took the group and we broke it down into little subgroups, each based on their expertise and experience with touching the process. And the goal was not perfection. The goal was knowing that free speech and getting universal agreement on, you know, free speech, because there are those who say there should be no rules, there should be no impediment whatsoever, and there are others who say we've got to keep people safe. How do we balance that? So the question is, can we really improve the process? Maybe not perfect it, not remove all the angst, but can we really improve it, meaningfully improve it, so that these kind of major events can happen, and there's a great likelihood that they won't spiral into something where we would have to take disciplinary action, or if it did, then it'd be very clear, and most people would agree that it had crossed that line, right? Most, not all, I'm sure.
Never all. Never all, I know that much.
And so it was a daunting task, and I wasn't sure how far we'd get with it, but as we organized and people gathered the facts, what was amazing to me is almost everything that we were interested in and were looking at is actually published somewhere under the Cornell University domain. But it's standing as to policy and its connections to the campus code and finding the information was not easy. Is it applicable or not? There was some conflicting information, and some of that conflicting information was in fact in circumvention or countervention of the campus code. We identified that. It was very rare. But there were a couple places where it said things that, you know, the code says no. And so we looked at that and tried to see if we can improve it. And we did have some of the, I call them the professional activists,
If there's a protest, they're there. As part of the committee. And at first I thought, well, how are we going to achieve a consensus of that? But it turned out to be good because they gave us perspective of how things can be misused, how things are perceived, even whether they were intended to be perceived that way. And I'm sure Chief Zoner was very knowledgeable on all aspects of the issue, but I found some of the discourse, it helped me really frame things about how a group that feels marginalized or feels like how they might perceive some of the stuff, and culturally, and coming from, you know, the Middle East and other places, how other organizations have tried to quash dissent, and how things here, even though there's, you know, we would never do that, right? Mm-hmm. But how it could be done, and so don't be stupid about it, you know? Human beings are in Cornell, and human beings are in all these other places, and so, you know, how can we do that? And so let me talk about the policy aspects of it. A lot of the things that say what we can and cannot do on university grounds are all in all kinds of places. At some point it's in the Cornell Charter where they talk about the establishment of Cornell Police and, you know, rights of sheriffs and deputy sheriffs. But it's in student handbooks and faculty handbooks. There isn't policy 1.1. governance and use of, you know, that has this list of things. It's like, so when you get into the student handbook, it says you cannot have alcohol at events or university permitting process or use of university property, UUP process, that says, you know, you have to have permission to use alcohol of age or not of age and things like that, is on the SLECA webpage and is ostensibly approved by the Dean of Students. So is that binding on me as a staff member or a faculty member? So everybody agrees that the process was reasonable, but what was it standing among the different groups? The best articulated set of reasonable requirements was on the SLECA page and connected with student organizations. I think that seems logical for where the most of the nearby population are undergraduate students, and they're a passionate group, and, you know, so that process naturally evolved. They also have staff to deal with these kinds of things, you know. And so after looking at it and talking to the selected people, one of which was on our committee, they talked to their folks and they said, yeah, we'd be willing to take this on for the university. In other words, one of the things that we found was, it was kind of clear, especially from Chief Zoner's standpoint, what should be happening where, but it's less clear if you're an eminent faculty member, does this apply to you, or an employee? And, you know, when it's in, I wouldn't necessarily read the student handbook, right, although everything there seems generally reasonable. So you don't want to have cases where somebody can be held accountable under the code and not reasonably been informed if they had done, at some level, their own due diligence, right? So we one of our recommendations is that because they have the staffing, because they get used to getting the requests, and in the view that adding the rest of the university's staff and faculty to this process was manageable by them, and they concurred with that, that they should be put in charge of the university wide. It's like a, you know, student leadership and engagement. The last part of the CA part of campus activities, you know, it's kind of inclusive, but when you start with the SL, people kind of go,
you've already turned off the,
you know. And so we recommended that they be given the authority to, you know, that there be one ring to rule them all, that ring be promulgated by SLECA, and that their websites should be the ones that tell everybody what is required and not required and what forms need to be done and when they need to be done and those kind of things. And then be very clear that they've been given this responsibility, even though they have, you know, they come under the Dean of Students, that they're in charge of this for the university, for the efficiency sake of the university. And then there were definitely some cases that I think even Gina was involved with in her time in that area that she may have even developed or were developed under her guidance. They had some of the best information available to everybody about how to go about this sensibly, and with reorganizations and moving on of people, nobody was in charge of that slice of the Cornell domain. It sat there, nobody touched it, and nobody owned it. And so we said, that should begin to suck up. They should take ownership of that, they should begin ownership of that, and then the other unclaimed places. There was also the Resource 25 set of pages of how you do classrooms and get places like here. I don't know if this is on the list, maybe not, but you know, any places like this, you know, should be listed, and the outdoor spaces should be explicitly there, and there should be connections between these websites. So I guess one of the key recommendations was consolidate, put somebody in charge, give them the authority, and then everybody has one process. Eminent professor, staff working for eminent professor, students, grad students, and this is outside of protest rallies and marches. This is just as a general one-stop shop for how do you reserve space and what is your obligation to pay for that space, clean up that space, return that space when you leave. And oh, by the way, outdoor spaces matter too. And if the rules are different, what are those rules? Getting into some of the more specifics, I was surprised to learn that there's like 14 different identified areas. I mean, 14 could be the wrong number, but it's a significant number of places down that row outside of, you know, on Hope Plaza that are that you can hold events. And I'm not exactly sure that there are markers on the ground, but people say, well, I want to reserve a spot outside there. It's not always clear where that is, and you don't know necessarily who's next to you, and they could be having a noisy event. Again, it might or might not be a protest rally. So we basically asked that if they're going to define spaces, that they put out a general stick drawing that says, you know, and space 1 through 12, so you know what you're signing up for. And if you're paying attention, you can see who's beside you, right? All this seems a little bit common sense. And so as we started working through the process, that would be an assistance not only to outdoor pickets, marches, and rallies, but to everybody, that there's a one-stop shop on how to do this. The university does have a need to keep people safe. To the protest rally part that says, we should be able to come anytime and do that kind of stuff. Well, if you're going to block traffic, what about the ambulance that needs to get through to the emergency call in Rand Hall, third floor, when I heel over in this chair? Okay? So there was a desire on the President Sporton floated after some discussion about voluntary advance notice. And the protest community at Cornell rejected that any notice is a bad thing. But you can understand that the intent of the notice was not so the police could have cameras there to tape you and hold it against you in the secret, I don't know, bubble. But to make sure that water's there, that they have access routes in case they need to get people in and out, you know. But you can also think from the protest side, if you don't believe in the goodwill and other things, that and the reason that the campus code is under the University Assembly stems from the Vietnam War era when deans didn't like what you did at some protest rally and held you accountable, and there was no policy or anything else, and so they couldn't toss you out because you were no longer of the appropriate character to attend Cornell University. And you know, so you have to balance both sides. So one thing was one-stop shopping where all faculty, staff, students can go to get information. And that
would be speaker, SLECA?
SLECA. Well, it was the recommendation that responsibility be given to SLECA because they deal with the bulk of that now, and they have staff to do it, and they were willing, at least at that time, the leadership at that time, to take it on. Else a new office would have to be created. That's funding, financing, and a whole other thing, and we were not trying to...
And they would be in competition with each other anyway for space, right?
So
it wasn't going to be in competition?
If you create a secondary room
only
for staff and faculty,
that
makes sense separate. You're using the same spaces, so oversight being given to one group. And
can you spell the acronym SLECA?
SLECA, I'm sorry.
S-L-E-C-A.
Student Leadership, Engagement, and Campus Activities. slug up. So and I looked at their website today, that at least hasn't changed.
The website, the landing page that has all of you, eventplanning.cornell.edu.
Okay, so I'm kind of handling things a little out of order, but that was our task. And when we got into it, we found there was a lot of common ground. The other thing that became apparent, and one of the best values that the protest side brought to the committee was, how about instead of telling us all the things we can't do, we do a set of rules or an FAQ page that says what we can do, what is permissible. You know, we all know that we're supposed to respect each other, but you know, what can we do? And what are we not required to do? Are we, you know, and so we made it clear, and we made 15 ultimate recommendations, you know, some being things should be under SLECA, SLECA should be in charge of the unclaimed web pages, but also that outdoor rallies and whatever do not have to pay fees if it's, you know, if it truly is. The key is you got to have policies that are not so burdensome that then organizations that aren't having a protest rally, but rather a rally, claim it as a protest rally because they don't want to pay the $20 or $50 fee, or somehow get, you know, it's got to all be manageable from all sides, and you don't want to set up policies that put students up for getting in trouble. You know what I mean? So you try and balance all this. So we said all outdoor space should have a common set of policies. All outdoor space common to Cornell should have policies. That's implied in a lot of places. It's overtly stated in various different ways in handbooks and other things, but there's not a universal place to look for that. We do believe all outdoor space, so whatever rules there are, or you know, you should not have to guess. And this is important also for non-Cornell sponsored things. Like in handbooks and in the UUP process, it makes clear that this is private property. If the downtown organization, be it however objectionable or however generous, can't just come in and set up a tent on Mill Plaza or anywhere else to hold an event, I mean, even if everybody thought it was a great one, they can't do that without a sponsor in the university. That sponsor can be a faculty member, that sponsor can be a student organization, but if that sponsor, that Cornell sponsor, is responsible to make sure that they know and comply with policies and procedures. So they can't sell stuff unless they have permission. They can't have a fire or an outdoor fire, you know, if without permission. They can't, you know, all of that. And so on. So ultimately, and what's really, you know, trying to cut to the chase of this, because it is all there, we recommended there would be a minimal set of outdoor space rules. We listed 7. We did not say they needed to be in the campus code, but I have said in follow-on conversations with President Scorton and President Garrett that I think that would be the best place for them, because it makes it clear, it makes it simple, and it gives standing or clarification when something's in the student handbook now, that these also apply to faculty, staff, and other people. The fact is, though, with the exception of one, all of these exist in Cornell policy, and people can be held accountable for them now, and I don't think they would get off on a perceived technicality of that doesn't apply to me, that's only the student handbook. I think if the JA or the HR processes decide to call you to a disciplinary thought, you've already lost that. Okay? That you can try. Don't know how it will turn out. But they shouldn't be guessing, and they shouldn't be trying to do something that they don't know. And this doesn't say there are protests that can violate the rules. The question is, when will they be held accountable and when shouldn't they? Right? So a protest can be quite peaceful, or it can damage property. If you damage property, you can be held accountable. I don't care whether you comply with all the rest of the stuff, right? So it's just letting you know where the boundaries are. You're going to choose as an individual or group. And only, you know, so I think you get it when you think about it. But one, so this is Appendix C, and it's a one-pager, but it reiterates that only members of the Cornell community may hold or host events on Cornell-owned property. External groups must be sponsored by a member of the Cornell community, and the sponsor must have a representative during the actual event. For these purposes, appropriate Cornell sponsors are registered student organizations, department and units of the university, university-sponsored organizations and offices. You know, we define the list. That's how it's handled now in the UUP, but again, the UUP is under the Dean of Students, and you know, the campus code is clearly involved more than students. Events must comply with applicable laws, regulations, and university policies. Does anybody think that that's an egregious statement? I hope not, but an external organization may not be familiar with university policies, and they may not know that a permit might be required, you know, things like that.
Just a quick question, I'm sorry. So were the people that were protesting in November of 2012 from outside the university?
The bulk of them were organizations associated with the university. I would not be surprised if there were people who were not Cornell-affiliated that were part of the groups, but nobody took attendance.
Yeah. The issue on November 2012 was there were two groups, and they were counter-protesting.
Okay, but they were Cornell groups.
Largely Cornell affiliates. Again, there was no real way to go.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay.
Generally,
but there were folks outside of the community involved.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So I'm just wondering if that statement applied to that incident specifically or for instance.
No, and none of the things here, that event triggered the investigation,
right,
triggered the recommendations, which ultimately triggered this. This is intended to be universal. So the fact that we track it back to that November at Hope Plaza has nothing to do with what they were doing.
Right.
It's looking at how that and other major protest events have affected this, and how can we remove the angst that isn't on point.
Right.
There's the issue that's being protested. Got it.
Right.
How do we keep people out of trouble and knowing where the boundaries are, and we collectively agree that when somebody's crossed the line, how we might hold them accountable. And we don't want that to be a surprise. We don't want that to be a surprise. Classes, research, scheduled events and activities, and the normal and essential operations of the university shall not be disrupted. That's in the campus code. It's also in the student handbook. Individuals and groups have the right to engage in protests and counter-protests. However, no one may substantially interfere with another speaker's right to be heard or the rights of others to hear a speaker. That's currently in the campus code. That's no change. No change. Persons may not block public rights of way or ingress or egress into and out of university buildings. That's safety code and common sense and EHS regulations. But for a protester who wants to link arms and prevent ingress and egress, there are safety reasons why Cornell University does not want that to happen. You can protest quite forcefully without doing that. Some might disagree. The bulk of people would not. No permit or registration is required for picketing, marches, rallies, or other demonstrations held on outdoor campus property. Other events are subject to event registration requirements located at eventplanning.whatever. Those.com. All of those are currently in the campus code or referenced in the campus code or other policies and handbooks that everybody is currently accountable for. But again, they're not all in one place. And you can play arguments of standing. This is after the fact when you're in the jury box. You know, but not before, you know. Now, the one that we added, which is based on event planning thoughts and other informal guidance that has been around for a long time but is not codified. Use of public address systems and amplified sound will be permitted without prior approval during the hours of 12 and 1 p.m. at Hope Plaza and in front of Dame Hall. Public address systems and amplified sound will be permitted in other outdoor locations only with prior approval. Approval may be obtained using the event registration stuff. So, amplified sound is a big, big issue. It really is. Everybody, especially in the context of counter-protest. And what this is saying is that you have the universal right at Cornell because it's a special place to scream on Hope Plaza and include in front of Bay Hall from 12 to 1 without permits or restrictions. The current UUP process, at least it used to say, and the some of the websites I was looking were still copyrighted in 2012, so forgive me, but I don't think some of the nuances has been adopted, would say that use of amplified sound requires a permit. And we get in this gray area, well, if one group has a thing, then where it got gray for the committee was, you're protesting, you have a permit for amplified sound. I'm coming to counter-protest. The reason that the university requires a permit for amplified sound is to not disrupt nearby activities. If they've given you a permit, then by default, I can use amplified sound because clearly Cornell's interest in preventing amplified sound has been satisfied because you have a permit. Are you following that logic?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just confused as to I've never participated in a protest. I've never done anything protesty-wise, so I'm not quite sure how this works. But it would, just from a layperson's standpoint, I would assume that a protest is like people just coordinate amongst their group, amongst themselves, and would start to protest. So I guess my main question is, and as blunt as it sounds, was this document created to make it easier to find those that do not follow those rules, an easier way to prosecute them?
No.
It's actually the opposite. It was more to provide a forum where people could go and seek out the rules and choose to violate them if that was what their intent was.
Right.
But to clarify the use of time and space so that time, place, and manner restrictions could be applied as appropriate if something were disrupted.
Yeah, I
kind of disagree with you on the end point of what you were saying, like, oh, just because we gave this person permission to have 5 down, then therefore...
No, there was disagreement there, but that was the protester's view.
Right.
I don't need to get that. You would be hard-pressed to hold me accountable for that because Cornell's interest in amplified sound has been satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because
that was the thing, right?
Right.
But where this all gets ugly is when you're dealing with a scheduled protest and an unscheduled protest, or two scheduled protests.
Mm-hmm.
Which Chope Plaza spaces permit.
Right.
You know, if there's enough space in there, you can have two groups in there doing their own thing. So that's where it gets contentious. Where it starts to get applied then later on, those are still tough to figure out. You just have to be there in order to figure out what the circumstances are. Where those two things then get taken well, it works here, then it must work in the Statler Hall, where, you know, I can, well, they have amplified sound, so I can have amplified sound for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why this was targeted to outdoor spaces. And that's why specific areas were designated as amplified sound and ours were designated as amplified sound availability. Because pretty much when you operate outside of those time frames on any other location or at any other location, you're disrupting someone's class
or
someone's meeting or someone's function.
And so coming back to the events of November 19, 2012, it greatly some would say ruined a wedding happening in Sage Chapel.
Yeah.
It was so loud and so boisterous that it was, I mean, I don't know whether they will lovingly look on it 20 years hence, but at the time, you know, and they paid money to have their wedding there. I don't know, $5,000, maybe more. And this protest, or this counter-protest, impacted that.
Right.
And so, in addition to those rules, we published an FAQ space. Now, this was some of the hardest work done, and I know Chief Zoner was very involved with how far do we take it, because some of the protest community wanted, you know, 40 pages of things, but we all agreed on a small subset. And we talked about this is a special place. This is a special place, and protest and passion are part of an educational experience like we would hope you would get on campus at Cornell. And so if there are facts here that say things like, you know, your expectations, as if you're going to organize a protest, you need to be reasonable and prudent, and
and know when you when you're talking to a university official and when you have to comply and when you know what when they can say yes, show me your ID card, and when you don't have to, and you know things like that. Clarifying that, but also telling groups that aren't protesting that Cornell's a special place, and other people may be protesting, and by signing up to have space 3 in front of Hope Plaza, you might be inconvenienced by a protest that you had no idea might be coming. Maybe because it was spontaneous, maybe because it was planned last minute, or maybe because you just didn't see who else was going to be around you.
Right.
And that as a Cornell citizen, Slack will do everything to help you reschedule your event. It's, you know, there's all these rules about how many events you can have per semester and things like that, that they will compensate you in the sense of trying to help you reschedule events so you can make it up. But don't
do that with the wedding.
Well, yeah, but that you understand by going in, especially a whole plaza place, this is a university with dynamic things happening all the time, and somebody, a couple times a year, is might be inconvenienced by it, and that's just part of the deal too.
Mm-hmm.
And that they have a right to be there, and that they have a right to voice their opinion. And within certain, you know, reasonable bounds, you have the inconvenient right to be inconvenienced.
Right.
So these things are meant to work together. The rules to make it clear what you can do and reasonably apply, you would not be held accountable under the code for something serious. Outside of these, you'd be against the code and you might or might not be held accountable. You know what I mean? This is in all the cases. There's a judgment there and in how quickly you comply and, you know,
and
all this kind of
there's a process by which that's determined.
Right.
Anyway, it's not just because we forward or someone else forward something for the JA doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be an outcome.
And if the JA forwards it, there's no guarantee that you would be found at fault. And, you know, there's a whole process. But being in that process itself is a distraction to you as a student or a staff member. So there may be no penalty, but you did perhaps suffer some in the process. Anyway, that's the intent of the report. There's a lot to it. It is not perfect. At the end of the day, we all reached agreement, including our student protesters, but then at the last minute when it became clear we were going to actually try and sign and submit, they were like, well, I want, you know. And so we said, how about, can you agree to this? And basically, we allowed them to write a statement of dissent in there because they basically said, well, we don't really find fault with this minimal set, but it doesn't go nearly far enough as far as they're concerned in protecting. And I think you should respect that in the sense that, like, the Supreme Court, you know, but it was very clear that even the protesters thought that this minimal set was reasonable and prudent, okay? Take that for what you will. We didn't publish it because over some of these protests. We published it, and then they added a commentary. And so it's very clear to me to this day, and I don't know how many big events we've had this year, but they will come again. You try and write policy that's going to last. That these are reasonable things. The campus code is a logical place to end any debate as to whether the rule applies or not. And then if somebody wants to change the rules, there's a formal process to address that. But you're under no obligation to do so. President Guerin, I believe, has forwarded it to you and wanted it adopted pretty quickly, right? You need to look at, I may have that wrong, but I think when I got the message that these were being supported and forwarded, I know that there were some emails and that would indicate there might be a quick turn on somehow on this, and I went, oh my.
And I can actually provide some color to that because this report was issued. As many of you know, I served as the executive vice chair under Jim last year, so it's always good to see you again, Jim. But the reason this came back was that, as Mr. Blair said, most of it is rehashing what's in the code. The code gives the president the authority upon reasonable time, consistent with the policy in the code, to define reasonable time, place, manner restrictions, hence the authority to promulgate that. President Garrett, upon taking office and approving the recommendation, sent it to the UA's interim summer executive board because we had, I guess, a hung UA for internal elections in the spring. We eventually met with Joel Molina and a number of other university administrators in an effort to talk about this. President Garrett actually ended up withdrawing her formal request, but in subsequent discussions that I've had with her and other interactions, she still voiced her support for this. So we're not under a formal do this in 5 minutes. But that being said, I spoke with Mr. Mezzi before his departure, hoping that CJC would meet before he left. They did not. Mr. Kaufman took over. I also briefed Mr. Kaufman that the CJC should very much look at this and consider it because it is consonant with the code. It follows the procedures. And encoding it into the code shows that shared governance is consulted, that shared governance has approved it, and it also allows it to create policy that's lasting. As Mr. Blair said, putting it in the code means that it can't be changed tomorrow. This was a community process, one that is, I believe, is fairly reasonable. I think most people would agree it is. And putting it in the code as an official stamp of approval and barring any enormous issues allows it to last and be a formal policy that allows Cornell to move forward and hopefully not have similar issues to Plaza.
The one thing that if you chose to do that, that you would be codifying is this definite amplified sound policy, which basically means outside of 12 and 1 in any place other than those listed or that you would choose to list, that it would require permission to use amplified sound. We provided no solutions as to whether, well, if you've got a firm in this space, then I'm covered. That is, I mean, this does not answer all the questions. The question is, would this improve, clarify, and we firmly believe it would. I did scanning before here, before I came to this meeting. The R25 system has been definitely rewritten, and I don't know how that's really been done. The FAQs and at least a list on the SLECA website of what the general consensus might be are not explicitly listed, or I could not find them. That doesn't mean that they aren't there, but I did look for like 30 minutes and couldn't stumble on them. So it does, whether you codify it or not, I think if you do not take some level of action to follow up on recommendations, if you find merit in them, then I think that this is at some point going to die unless President Garrett keeps it up. Again, it, you know.
If I may, just to respond to that, the question as to how these were to be codified, the President made a request of the UA/CJC when she first came on, that the CJC at the time said, you know, no, there were some questions about this stuff. She had a date by which, in fact, I'm reading through the Chronicle article now, she essentially codified them. She said they're existing policies right now. They all exist. The Hope Plaza Amplified Sound one exists as a Dean of Students policy. But she said, no, these were we took the recommendations. I, as president, am making them policy. They are. I think where it makes great sense is in this Students' Bill of Rights, where, again, what you're doing is you're pulling in all of the things you can and can't do and putting them front and center, because...
Well, that's a good point. That's another place where they might be...
What
these
are.
I don't know.
These lists of seven exist, but we don't know where they exist, so except for in this recommendation.
So my problem was not what she did, but the fact is that if these are not policy, search the Cornell website and see how long it takes you to stumble on...
Right.
Where you as a student trying to do your due diligence, or...
These are listed on the event planning page. That was that was done in concert with the Chronicle article. So that when you go to the event planning website, there is these are part of it. So that
I didn't see it, but I'm glad to know it.
I mean, I did.
Before I came here, and everything did circle back. I was pleased that no matter where I went, I was circled into the select website. And then I looked at the registration form or the event registration, the UUP process, and I saw the permits. I didn't see any explicit notification that outdoor picket, blah, 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 that is dumper fees and, you know, any of those pieces. I didn't see the facts. They could very well be there. I could not stumble on them. And part of what I would recommend that the university do is make sure that they are easy to stumble on. In those cases.
It's on the event planning website. We've added a whole link for outdoor events that are all part of it. Very intentionally to coincide with the release of this.
Awesome. I didn't see an outdoor event, so I may actually stumble across in some cases the old style web pages from the UP. So
I'm just had I had a thought on the whether or not it should be in the Community Bill of Rights or the Campus Code of Conduct. I think, you know, from reading the Campus Code of Conduct, it has a certain weight to it that is appropriate for time, place, manner restrictions that I don't think would be appropriate for a Community Bill of Rights. If it is something that wants that should be changed in the future, like if it's a binding thing, like if these are, I mean, like there are rights in the Campus Code of Conduct. So I think that the working group, you know, whether or not we choose to accept, you know, their report or make a resolution, I think that those would be rights that we would want to ratify, whether or not the president chooses to make them policy or not, or in the future change them. Because if we don't put it in the Campus Code of Conduct, and if it goes in the Community Bill of Rights, and then the president changes the policy, then we've got to change the Community Bill of Rights. But if we do put it in the Campus Code of Conduct, and the president tries to change the policy, then we, then we just veto. So,
well, you'd be consulted.
Right. Okay.
Don't think that she can't.
I know that there are emergency. I know that there are emergency provisions.
Website, it's the president approved and the university adopted as policy a minimal set of rules
right.
related to outdoor space.
Right.
It's already a policy.
Right.
Yes.
And so I think it would be valuable to codify it in the community, in the Campus Code of Conduct.
That's an internal thing.
Right.
It's open for debate, and I'm glad to see that.
And many of them are already
Did you have this?
And I was going to say, Mr. Jamerson, you're absolutely correct. And you're sure Joel briefed you on the meetings that we had with the executive committee with Joel and eventually with the council's office. The code states that policy, when duly promulgated, is binding, and a violation of policy is a violation of the code. It's listed in the code. That's Tiffany of council's office. Practice, obviously, aside. The reason that the exec asked the CDC to look at this is that President Garrett had made a request. Even though the formal request was withdrawn, in follow-on conversations, she expressed an interest in having it in the code. And I personally, as a representative of the UA and a member of Sharegrounds, I think it's valuable to say, you've requested that these be considered. If we find them with merit, then we should incorporate them. It does also, as Mr. Blair said, it gives it, I guess, a more permanence in that a new president, assuming obviously something catastrophic happens, heaven forbid, a new president could come in and just change those with a stroke of a pen. They are university policy. The goal being that this was consulted with by the community. It was a relatively, it was a very wide subset of the community, including those on both sides. They come up with a set of recommendations which were adopted, and that the CJC look at that and say, if these represent what we think the community should be, incorporate them into the code to formally recognize that they are recognized by the community and live in the code. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
A little different tack. Remember that the Campus Code applies to Geneva, it applies to, so, think through in consequences and unintended consequences, okay? And, you know, you say, heaven forbid, something would happen, but in the life of Cornell University, there will be new presidents.
Yes.
And the population will change, and the views of what's important and not important, and how, I don't know. I mean, the Campus Code is very clear about civil discourse. People know that, and yet, it's really a matter of the dynamics that he discussed and how you view them, and think about 100 years from now. And presidents will be different, administrations will be different. There will always be some code, and the question is, how do these things get changed, and what new process or is used to change them? The Campus Code, you shouldn't be too specific in the Campus Code unless you mean to be, because it's hard to change. Not only in theory should you be writing change, but then the administration has to accept it, and given the life of students and everything else, and how long it takes to get up on these issues, and, you know, the 2-year appointment issue on the Community Bill of Rights is, you know, so you got to be cautious with all these things about what you do. I personally think the Campus Code is a very enduring thing, and report, you know, it does force, at least in today's environment and for the foreseeable future, some connection before these fundamental provisions would be tampered with. But, you know, again, policy is policy. And if they change the policy, you don't like how they change the policy, it's always your right to comment on it. I mean, so don't think you've lost the entire battle if you don't codify it.
A lot of it's already in there.
And realizing that that debate could take a while in itself, are there questions about the report and the intent of what we're trying to do? Because we made 15 recommendations, and clearly several of them have been, not all of them, I guess, some of them have been implemented. Is there anything I can answer for you or clarify?
So, I don't remember if you sent me the full report.
I did.
Oh, you did? Okay, then.
The full report, the signed version.
Okay, then I will be sure to send that to you guys as soon as possible. That way we can kind of be on the same page there.
And if you've already deleted it for some reason, I'll be glad to send it to you.
I tried. I don't think I did, but we'll see. I'm not good with computers.
If I can just add on top of all this, especially for people just joining, some of the history behind this, November 2012 was the issues were between the two groups. The conversation became about the police intervention between the two groups. So that's what went off into this other direction of who has rights to what property and where, because that's our job. When we go in, we try to figure out who's supposed to be here, who's not supposed to be here. And it didn't go well from the perspective of the community. From our perspective, we did what we always do. We saw a fight brewing, we stepped in, we tried to stop the fight. As it turned out, both sides actually wanted the fight, not physically. They were having a good verbal interchange, and there was a conversation of what the acceptability of that verbal interchange would be was above what we normally would accept. So part of this conversation is not in policy anywhere, is what does our community want on our behalf? How do they want us to intervene? I mean, imagine being the only employee, literally, on this group, on this campus, that cannot attend a protest without causing problems. If we want to go, we're genuinely interested in the issues, we show up in plain clothes, oh, we're spying. We show up in uniform, oh, we're trying to control it. You know, we're oppressing people. So here I am trying to educate myself, can't go to teach-ins, can't go to the protests. And then we're also called to serve from the perspective of safety. So we got a gathering of 150 people, and they're, you know, 50% of each is against one another. We see a strong potential for violence there, we're going to show up. So now what we've come to is much less of a presence on demonstrations. I can't remember the last demonstration we actually showed up at since that conference, because we were promised by the community they would monitor their own behavior, and they've done so. So there is no need. Now, if somebody in that group feels frightened, intimidated, you know, whatever, they can call us and we'll call them. Absolutely. But we used to go strictly.
No, I was saying I want to get two nuances.
We're running out of time. So before we do that, I'm actually going to ask for a motion to extend the meeting by 10 minutes.
So.
Okay, and then in order to do that, I'm going to recognize Jim one more time to close up.
And then
you can add.
The events of Bill Plaza, despite all the rigmarole and gnashing of teeth and pointing fingers at the police, nothing was ever proven, and frankly, even less than proven, nothing was actually insinuated that bore any weight. And as Kathy Zoner said at one point, there would have been a cell phone capturing something. If any of my officers had done anything, they shouldn't. It would have been on film. And I guarantee you, and I also know how she handles and thinks about these things, and, you know, you're well served. I'm a big fan. Separately, you will note, why outdoor space? I didn't really talk about outdoor space, but the indoor space is subject to much more rules. We read the statement about things, and it's all in the campus code, but there's much more rules about what you can do inside a building versus outside. And, of course, we have a lot of people who drive across our campus and people who walk outside just because they're getting from here to there, and we got student groups, and we got prospective freshmen and their parents and weddings and all this other, and people delivering Pepsi Cola to the machines. Okay, they're not Cornell people, but they can be brought up in these things, or maybe they see something going on that they don't like, and, you know, so outdoor spaces have to be careful. You know, a little bit differently.
Yeah, it's private public space.
Right. It's private public space, which is why some of this is a little, why the outdoor space was a little more, we're trying to put a little more clarity on, you know, everybody can be here, and yet there are rules that apply here to protect students and faculty and staff and those kind of things. And so I just remember, like, if you can go in the building, protesters can scream all they want outside the building to some extent. What about people trying to get in? You know, if I stand this close to you, am I intimidating you? I mean, what's the setup?
Yes.
You know, there are things like that that we have not defined, and this is where the judgment of the police is called.
This is likely will come and say, no, come on, get real.
Right.
I mean, this is a conversation. It's a very clear conversation. Any reasonable person would call it a conversation. There's no intimidation intended here. But we also acknowledge that there are groups who are disenfranchised and marginalized that may not believe that that's not where they are. So we're trying to build a level of trust, combating perceptions of police that might be doing it wrong elsewhere.
Which is my final point. So you can't codify everything, and if you attempt, you will make things worse. This is why the UA oversights the police, the JA. They get to have a say on JA appointments, JCC appointments, judicial appointments. You are considered to be the body that is the check on whether there's enough merit at some level that something's getting out of whack. Because the code can't list everything. You know it when you see it, but if you try and code it and try and perfect it, it's just not possible. And the tighter you grasp everything, you know. So this is why you should expect, or the UA should expect, Chief Soner to come before the assembly every year, even if you have no overt concerns. But this is where you canvass the community. Is any, before we're having Chief Soner in a month, and we announce our meeting, the Chief Soner is going to speak about the statistics and stuff, and why you broadcast that so that if at no other time people come forward and say, you know, one person is one person. 7-8 people from 7 different instances, maybe you need to pay attention. You would hope that would never happen, but that's part of how you keep the reality in balance without over-legislating, but it all works together. You can't publish rules and say it's on its own. Chief Zoner will someday retire, and you know, the next police chief may or may not have the same perspective or experience, you don't know. So it all works together. But if you let, it's a house that needs all sides to work. And so, but the code doesn't stand alone. Your oversight of the police, your oversight of the judicial process, your appointment and interviews of those people who get appointed to the people who make the decisions of who gets tossed out and who gets let go, that's all very important. Once you appoint them, you've got to trust that they're doing it right. Okay? But you check in periodically and you let the community tell you and give you feedback and don't expect perfection. And you know when something begins to rise above the noise floor and that you need to look into it. That's part of your due diligence. That's why your committee is one of the most valuable here. And if everything's working reasonably well, people don't even necessarily know you exist. But I guarantee in the life of Cornell University, there's some years where you were absolutely at the forefront, far more than you would want to be. End of speech.
I think Gina had one thing to add.
I do. It's more of a, in full disclosure, I was the event manager at the Hope Plaza event, so I was very, very involved in that. I was very, very involved in the conversations Matt was just describing regarding the President Garrett coming into this outdoor working space group and formed a lot of that. My perspective, I'll have to, if and when I speak about it, I'll make sure that which hat I'm wearing, because prior to working here in the Office of the Assembly, event management was part of my portfolio. So I came at that particular event. I was part of the report. I had a pretty unique perspective in mind that I just need to make sure that you're all aware of as I'm speaking. It's not just from a... I just want to make sure that everybody was aware of that.
And in the process of it, she got severely criticized, and nothing was... She did her job. She did her job very well, just like Kathy's owner and her officers did their job.
And the process just did their job. I mean, the whole issue was that people were doing their jobs. It was that there was a lot of change in the cultural way, and we accept that things
get done. And there were no nuanced lead-ins to that change. So it wasn't like, oh, it's a little tweak here, a little tweak. It was like, yesterday it was like this, and today it was like that, and there was, it was like flabbergasting and knowledge. So that shifted that conversation into a place where, you know, I have engineered protests from the police perspective on the back side of it, where I have called national media to protest. I have accommodated traffic so that when intersections were taken over, that people could get to work because the buses weren't inconvenient. Mm-hmm. They knew ahead of time they could go on another route. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of things in that, and I did not jump up from there. I did that. I just did it because it made the voice be heard, and then less people we might have brought to the table into the conversation could stop and listen to it because they weren't so distracted by it.
And the level of sophistication is so high. So, to keep you from getting out of control, so, you're here to be arrested, right? Is there anybody here to be arrested?
Yes.
Do you want the cameras here before I do it? Do you want the cameras here before I arrest you?
Yeah.
And they say yes or no, whatever, and you can... I mean, she orchestrated people. You achieve your goals, your publicity, whatever they may be, and everybody's been safe. Right? That's how sophisticated the police are and how she acts. If you don't know it, you have a gem. You have a gem. And if people tell you they're combat booted thugs, I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
And if I got one, I'll listen to it. Believe me, it's usually pretty clear when somebody's acting out of the charge.
But if you're an oppressed group from a different part of the world, you may not believe it. I'm telling you, you know, there's two sides to every story. Always check with the other side before you react, especially in your role sitting here.
So, yeah, that's... Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation. I'll forward out the report to you guys for you to consider. We'll probably we'll be talking about this at our next meeting. I was switching there. We are running a little low on time, but I wanted to make sure that we addressed item 3, which is staffing the university hearing and review boards today. Before we do that, I'm actually going to ask for another 10 minutes, or for a motion to, okay, thank you, sorry. So about the staffing process, so I drew up kind of a rough timeline. Or does everyone here know what the UHRB is? Is there anyone who's got some questions? No? Okay, so we will be staffing the UHRB this spring. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you for having me.
The first step in the process is opening the application. The second step is closing the application. Then we'll be reviewing the applications and ultimately, making a recommendation to the University Assembly to approve members. So what I wanted to discuss with you guys was, you know, what do you think would be a good time frame to do that? I know that Gina mentioned that, we want to make sure that we keep the Office of the Assemblies in the loop because they have a lot to manage. So I wanted to make sure that we have that discussion. One thing I'd like to change or make you guys aware of is, as of right now, students will be on break during that Tuesday, March 29th, so I don't think we'll be able to meet then. So I would recommend a day, maybe a day after that or in April. But Gina, what did you have in mind?
I thought we were meeting on Thursday to come up with something that would actually fit. I think trying to... have you all come to a decision that doesn't fit into our calendar is a little tricky. So
what are the constraints that the Office of the Assemblies faces?
Well, this is a process. All really, you know, once we determine the date, is we send out, we open up the portal, we publicize it,
right.
People submit, once we get the pool, we give it to you. But I think because it's a process that is dealt entirely by the office, and as I explained to you, we have several other elections going on. It needs to be well coordinated with all those, so nobody's expectations are.
So what precisely does it take to open the applications?
It's a Qualtrics survey that we've created. Uh-oh. It's publicizing that through listservs that we manage. It's working with the JA's office. So it's not something that this body can do by itself, is what I'm suggesting.
You don't, has you don't think that the CJC would be, I mean, obviously we can't do it by ourselves, right? But you don't, so when do you think would be an appropriate time? Like, what do you think would be a good time?
We set up a time on Thursday to discuss that. I don't have my calendar.
Okay. Well, I do want to make sure that we hammer out the dates today. So I know that the Office of the Assemblies is going to coordinate.
I'm going to respectfully ask that you not do that because we cannot, whatever date you come up with, I don't have the obligations that we have that might be in conflict with that in front of me right now. So rather than you set dates that we're going to have to then juggle or be in conflict with, I'm going to respectfully ask that you, that's not a priority, quite honestly. There's plenty of time, as long as this is done this semester, I would respectfully ask that you table that for the next meeting, after which time you and I have chatted, and you know what's going to be best for the UHRP.
So then let's have the discussion right now. So,
Mr. Kaufman,
okay.
Speaking solely as the chair of the assembly, Gina, we always, as you know, we appreciate very much the work of your office. I mean, the committee is free to choose its own priority. I would, though, to a certain extent, echo Ms. Jamerson's statement insofar as, well, the committee picks the priorities. Picking, I think, for the new members, the UHRB, is, so if you're under the code, there's an offense, there's a decision. They're the adjudicating body, they're the appeals body, the university hearing and review boards. For students and staff, you apply on a Qualtrics survey. That application is then collated, brought to us. This committee then determines roughly whether or not it should be on the committee, which is then forwarded to the University Assembly for approval. Faculty will through the Dean of Faculty, which is then forwarded to the University Assembly for approval. We generally, over the past couple years, have struggled to get this done on time. Last year was the first year in a number of years we had managed to, which was actually quite fortuitous due to the status of the Assembly over last summer. This is important to get rolling. The dates getting set up right now is not the most important thing in the world. Mm-hmm. I think the general...
Just knowing that it's on our...
Yes, and doing it sooner rather than later. I mean...
Right. And that's why I wanted to have like a general discussion about what the time frame you could offer would be. Like,
you're meeting on Thursday to discuss that. I'm not prepared. I don't have the matrix of calendars that I showed you in our office that has the dean of faculty election, the trustees election, the essay,
right.
The
so
TA,
could you,
all of that factors into this.
Would
when
you,
we can actually operationally support this process.
Uh-huh.
And
could
I don't
you,
know that right now.
Just so I understand, because you know this is my first time. What would be like a potential conflict? Like let's say there was like an election where that was happening on February 23rd. What would the what would one of the problems be with sending the Qualtrics survey out or opening up the Qualtrics survey also on that day?
We have a staff of two, myself and a new employee, that will be running 7 other elections, full elections, probably contentious elections. We have a new dean of faculty, several trustees, the essay. All of that is coordinated. It's choreographing what? It's choreographing a show. Pushing a button and monitoring the income into a Qualtrics survey takes somebody doing that. I don't know if we can do that until you and I coordinate when that can actually happen. We'll come up with some options. You can bring it back to this group. That's all I can offer you at this point.
Okay.
And in the past,
I think Richard has something to say.
And as a procedural thing, I don't think in the past we've ever, as a group, had to approve dates or anything. We just do the process. The only thing we had to approve is once that information.
Right.
So if I might just make a question, we do want to have a discussion on this. We can keep it general, saying how long do we want the application open for,
right.
How much time do we want to review the applicants, and how long before that do we send them to the UA. Looking at this, it seems that we have 3 weeks of open applications, and I think 3 weeks is a reasonable time. Do we want them approved by our last meeting, by our second or last meeting? So these are the kinds of things that we can have a conversation about. Now, it doesn't have to be a hard and fast date.
Right, that's exactly what I was talking about. These are tentative dates.
Yeah, so ignoring the actual dates, let's begin to find a time frame, but it's like a week of we would work the office assembly to find a date that's not in conflict with them. So, in terms of that, I think two of those applications is all we need. And I would say the second to last meeting, not the last meeting, just knowing that we're going to have a huge, excellent increase of things to do. Having it, the approval of the names as the second to last meeting be our final deadline, and saying 2 weeks to open applications and maybe another week for us to review the applications might be the tightest timeline that we possibly need.
And just from the UA's point of view, this committee has always been fantastic in reviewing it. I'm not overly concerned. I think the goal of this, honestly, is probably going to be exactly to make sure that the committee is aware of it. Hard and fast dates are not critical. I'm sure Mr. Kaufman and Mr. Amatista will hammer it out. Worst case scenario, I'm always available to assist, but I imagine things will go smoothly. I agree that we haven't had to do necessarily deal with dates in the past. It's not the issue is making sure it happens. Barring a catastrophe, I don't think the ethical committee needs to be involved.
So I think that based on the time frame that Richard set up, that maybe like at least a good time to send out the Qualtrics survey would be sometime in February. Is that it seems like if you start it in March, we might not get it done by the end of the session.
I mean, I think that's really dependent when you meet with Gina and look at the calendars and make sure, because I know, like she said, the student trustees are going on.
I think that's in late April.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's a fair point, like Richard said, set out a group of lofts rather than setting down even like a range of dates, because like Gina said, there's two people, like, they probably have so much work to do, so. Maybe just wait until Thursday and then you can send us definite dates as long as we hammer down a time frame.
Okay. So a good time, we're thinking 2 weeks for applications, mm-hmm. and we want to have a resolution to present to the UA by the penultimate meeting. It'd be the third week in April.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, the Qualtrics survey is the application.
Yeah.
It doesn't, when you're talking about saying it's February and you're having a 2 weeks, application period, that's what it is. They're not two separate things.
Okay. Okay. I think, does anyone have anything else to say on that?
And also, it's done hand in glove with the Office of the Judicial
right.
Administrator.
Right, right, right.
So they actually have I'll see if someone from their office can join us, but they would actually have to take in that data as well. It can't be done unilaterally.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to ask actually that I didn't put this on the agenda, but I'd like to make sure that we approve the minutes from the last meeting so that they can go on the dashboard.
My name is spelled wrong.
Your name is spelled incorrectly? Okay. So can I have a motion to amend?
It's a typo. We don't need
it. It's a typo? Okay. Then can I have a motion to approve the minutes, or do we want to wait 2 weeks to review these? Is anyone going to make a formal motion to approve?
Any objections, I'd motion.
Okay. So is there a second? Second? Okay. Then I'm going to ask that this be approved by unanimous consent. Are there any objections? No? Okay. Then the last item is adjournment. So.
Okay. It is...
at 6:18.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.